Roz and Gregor crested the apex of one last staggering group of foothills and began their final descent into the river valley. The air grew cool and moist, soothing their parched skin. The leafy canopy of low-lying coniferous trees blocking the harsh rays of the afternoon sun. Unlike the shrub steppe farther south, wildlife abounded in the northern lowlands. Deer grazed here and there, freezing at the sight of the two bipedal interlopers, then bounded off into the brush. Squirrels chittered and gossiped in the trees, and murders of crows threw insults from the heights. Once, after Gregor had staggered off the path to take care of his own animal needs, he crossed paths with a hulking black bear. Hyper-evolved, self-aware organ that it was, Gregor's brain flipped effortlessly into lizard mode, bidding him freeze in his tracks at the sight of an apex predator. Distantly, he was aware that he no longer had to pee. The bear, perhaps having sated itself on something less abjectly terrified and better smelling, showed no interest in the stock-still hominid, and after having snuffled thunderously in Gregor's general direction, wandered with ursine nonchalance into the woods, there to conduct its business unimpeded by random simians. Random omnivores notwithstanding, the rest of the journey was uneventful. Gregor's feet had blistered and peeled and blistered and peeled again, but were finally hardening to the task of tramping across uneven ground. Roz, for her trouble, had noticed that she'd had to slow and wait for him fewer and fewer times per day, but she hadn't made a big deal of it. There was silence, but it was companionable. As they gathered dry twigs at dusk, Roz said, "This might be it then. Come tomorrow, we might have something that could end this, once and for all."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah. I've been thinking on this woman, Nedge, who I met years ago when I was still under Ivan's tutelage." Seven years ago. When Ivan asked Roz what she wanted for her birthday, she didn't hesitate. "I want to go to the block." Ivan, having sensed this well in advance, for it was good form for a teacher to be able to anticipate the inclinations of his charges, bid her pack her things and be ready to travel first thing in the morning. The journey through the woods had taken the better part of a week, but Ivan had, in that way of his, turned the journey entire into a learning experience. He'd shown Roz how to set a snare, and how to spear a fish while accounting for the angle of refraction. He'd shown her how to mend a sprain and bind a cut, and which roots to rub into scrapes to prevent mortification, and which flowers to avoid unless she wanted to die of spine-cracking convulsions. He pointed out birds and bugs and animal spore, and he built low, ruddy fires that cast little light, but just enough heat. But now they were here, the writer's block. Roz has never seen anywhere like it. The buildings here are grand, towering edifices of hewn stone, tributes to the art of writing. It is a metropolis in the purest sense of the word, its skyline bounded only by the northern mountains beyond. Roz walks the cobbled street next to her professor, who looks just as comfortable here as he is in his own practice hall. He smiles at pulp traders, large, bear-like men hauling great spools of rough paper on their backs, wholesaling to the masses. He stops to shoot the breeze with story vendors, hawking their wares from collapsible carts crammed shoulder to shoulder in the alcoves of towering skyscrapers. A newsboy, scruffy and gap-toothed, waves a homebrew broadsheet in Ivan's face, and the older man smiles and fishes an odd-looking coin from his pocket and flips it to the kid. The neophyte newspaperman catches it on the fly, tosses the maestro a paper, and then skips away into the thronged masses to ply his trade. Roz looks to and fro, then strays from her teacher's side and peers into one street-level window, and then another. Ivan watches, patient. "Strange," she says at length.
"What is?"
"Well, it's called the writer's block, isn't it? But where are all the writers?" Ivan smiles sadly and beckons Roz to follow him.
"I used to come here as a boy,"
he says, scooting to the side so that a massive pulp trader can lumber by on the sidewalk.
"My, but that must have been long ago,"
Roz says.
"Yes. In any case, I used to come here with my own maestro, mean old man named Ludwig. Ludwig was saying that the best music paper is coming from Block, and that no musician worth his rosin would stoop so low as to use the slippery synthetic stuff foisted upon us by those TR ingrates. Every fortnight, he is running out and sending me down the path to bring back huge roll paper. And if he is being extra prolific, Ivan is making again the trip. No rest. In any case, back then the block was a very different place. I remember hearing it before I could see it, and smelling it before I could hear it. Clacking carriages and churning pulp mills and whining printing presses. The stink of pulp and ink and industry. The writers used to fill these buildings to the brim, their typewriters setting up a din that could be scaring up a flock of buyer leaves at a kilometre away. Those who didn't own space or writing machines sat in the street, scribbling away at foolscap with pencils and quills and God knows what else. Rumour had it that some poor bastards were even using their own blood for ink.
Ivan enjoys the scandalized look this elicits in his pupil's face.
But back then, it was about the writing. Only about the writing. Now,
he says, and gestures towards another window, towards which Roz realizes he has been leading her. The writers sit in a clump in the middle of a dank room that might once have been a tavern. They write on silent, oblong machines that throw ghastly bluish luminescence onto their faces. Only their hands move, skittering spider-like across glossy keys. One of them, a wan young man sporting the ghost of a beard, blinks and raises his head as if breaking the surface of an unfathomably deep pool. He locks eyes with Roz, but betrays nothing before submerging himself once again in his labor. Roz shivers and backs away from the window.
"It is not all like that," Ivan says, "but it's enough to be making me nervous. These buildings," he says, gesturing around, "are no longer for writing. The men living in them are using books as currency, not as art. I think that something bad will come of this, but who would be listening to old man with broken nose? Not many."
They wend deeper into the city, drawing ever closer to a mammoth central spire whose height dwarfs all other structures around it. Soon, they stand before its door, itself the largest portal that Roz has ever laid eyes on. Its surface is inlaid with myriad letters from a dozen languages, 100. Words twist and writhe on its surface, telling some intricate story that Roz cannot even begin to interpret. She reaches out to touch it. Ivan stops her.
"Don't,"
he says, and she doesn't. Instead, She stands before the door and says, firmly but softly, Ex Libris Veritas. The door rumbles open before them. It's bigger on the inside, Roz hisses at her teacher, and not for the first time. The spire was, to put a point on it, the biggest library Roz had ever seen, which wasn't saying much. But books without number lined its walls, their spines describing multi-hued geometry that stretched in every direction, far beyond the bounds espoused by conventional physics. Instead of ending where any self-respecting walls should end, the book stacks trundled off into infinity. It was upsetting. Ivan, rather than being discomfited by the unconventional dimensionality of the place, responds, Oh, is it? Roz glares at him. They walk a circuitous route, taking lefts and rights seemingly at random, until they come to a door, this one also inscribed with runes, but far smaller in scale than its hulking brethren. It stands at just under Ivan's height, so that when he crosses the lintel, he ducks his head ever so slightly. As Roz watches, her teacher leans towards the crawling letters on the door's surface and chants something under his breath, almost alien-sounding compared to the Latinate. A tumble of syllables, repetitive yet arrhythmic. It hurts her head to hear it. Then, thankfully, her teacher ceases his disturbing intonation and steps aside as the door swings wide. It is dark in there, and Roz is afraid. What's in there? She asks. The book, he says. Ivan takes her hand in his own, and together they walk through the darkness. The blackness is absolute, and yet Roz thinks that she can see things, wrong things writhing in it. They caper and cavort and seemingly beckon to her, so she shuts her eyes, for it is no darker with them closed. Finally, after an interminable walk, she opens them to find herself in a warm, shabbily furnished office, golden sunlight streaming in through the windows. There are people here, some bustling to and fro, cleaning up bric-a-brac and dusting shelves. In a small, old-fashioned kitchen off to one side, an enormously fat man stirs a pot of delicious-smelling broth with one hand, idly flipping the pages of a positively ancient cookbook with another. In the middle of the room, a younger woman sits at a modest desk and writes in a large, tattered book. It takes Roz a full minute to realize what is wrong with the picture. They are all the same person. There he is, fat, cooking and reading. But there also he is, wafer thin, reclining on an overstuffed divan and perusing a glossy magazine. And there he is, rippling with muscles and roped with scar tissue, sweeping the floor near the entryway. And there too, at the modest desk, is he not a he, but a she. A slim, dark-haired girl with enormous brown eyes. Roz looks at her teacher, eyes questioning. Roz, he says, meet the librarians. The girl, who introduces herself as Nedge, reverently closes the book and bids her guests to make themselves comfortable. The skinny man, his space having been invaded, humphs grumpily and levers his stork-like limbs off the divan and ambles into the other room. Nedge shakes her head and the muscular one shrugs and resumes his sweeping. You're all... Yes, we're all I, the girl replies, but to explain it would pale in the telling. Oh, Roz says, crestfallen not to be privy to whatever arcane doings could have resulted in this multi-person. In any case, you're not here to hear my life's story. I presume you're here to see the book. Roz is indeed here to see the book. Even in the state, its existence is spoken of in terms of wonder. It is supposedly the first of its kind, a collaborative piece of art from before this world began. Its powers are legion, it said, and its knowledge unplumbed. It holds the arcane secrets of life and will burn to a crisp any person unworthy to but glimpse its splendor. It births worlds and metes out power according to its own whim. It is as big as a man and wide as a barn and glows with the power of a million suns.
I would very much like to see it, yes, Roz says.
Well, go on ahead, the girl replies. It's right over there. Roz thinks she's being had, for instead of gesturing towards yet another dizzily inscribed door, behind which lurks a thing of wonder, she instead indicates the tattered notebook in which she'd been scribbling previous.
You're kidding, Roz says.
I'm not, the girl chides. Roz treads carefully towards the book, or is it merely a book, she wonders, sure that she is on the receiving end of some illusory ambuscade designed to ferret out the pure of heart and strong of will. But there is no flash of light, no choir of silver-throated seraphim, just a beat-up notebook with a gaffer's tape cover, not unlike her own composition books at home. Still, she opens it and sees and understands. Minutes or hours later, she closes the book and steps away.
It's all in there, she says at length.
It is, Yvonne says.
Uh-huh,
the girl adds. And all of it, typewritten, and pencil and ink, and by God, was that blood?
No way,
Yvonne scoffs.
Maybe, Nedge says.
And who wrote it? How?
The how's fuzzy,
Nedge says, eating from a bowl of long noodles she must have acquired while Roz was reading. But the who is all of I have been coming here for millennia, knew I, when I am needed. We seven, she gestures around, are just the current seven. We all add to the book in part, and when our time is over, we fade, and new I take our place.
The great cycle,
Ivan intones, his face alight with mock seriousness.
Oh, please,
Nedge says, rolling her eyes.
It may be complicated and bizarre, but please save your proper nouns for someone who isn't burdened by a surfeit.
But in any case, this is the book, and it's... The heart of the writer's block, Roz said. And perhaps the last hope for our world.
So no pressure, Gregor said.
A grin played along the corners of Roz's mouth.
Nah, she said.
I figure we'll have this debacle entire mopped up by tea time. Gregor seemed pleased at his companion's uncharacteristic levity.
Good then, 'cause I got places to be.
Oh yeah? Where, pray? Gregor lay back against a boulder that, given his newfound travel grit, he found to be as comfortable as a feather mattress.
Ampersand,
he said, perhaps more than a little dreamily.
Ampersand?
Roz asked, her smile more than a quirk this time.
Oh, yeah. A small conclave of artificers, snugged right up into the center of the TR. Buddy of mine from school, a cat by the name of Heinrich, lit out for it right out of school. Dropped me a line here and there over the years, and truth, it put my dedication to Janice to the question. Not a letter of this went by when I didn't wonder how everything might have shaken out different had I followed him there. Got my own cushy little office, bracketed side by side by the cram's cram of young artificers making new things.
So why didn't you? Roz asked. Gregor shrugged, a little sadly. Neither of them had missed the intimation of Anatoly's apparent betrayal. But nor had either of them mentioned it. Funny how even a little sliver of time dulled the sharpest pain.
Why doesn't anyone do anything? I'd known Anatoly a long time, and he'd always been a dreamer. Had these huge plans like to change the world as we know it, and there was never a doubt in his mind that I was part of it. You ever have that?
What?
Someone who believes in a dream, believes in you, perhaps even more than you believe in yourself. Well, that was Anatoly. His vision for the future had its own gravity, and I let it pull me in.
Roz paused for a long moment, running her hands along the battered cello case. Its armored shell was nonetheless scored and runneled by innumerable insults, pokes and stabs and gashes. And yet there was a certain beauty to it, the beauty of things that have been through the fire. Yes, I have known people like that, and I hope one day to know them again. She looked at him significantly, but the intensity of her regard was such that he turned his eyes away. Roz was excited as she ever got. To ask Gregor, the taciturn young woman was a study in somber gravity, all singular intent. But at the edge of the woods, traipsing through the opaque thicket that served as a verge between the wooded wilds and the fringe of the block proper, he would have thought her a young woman on the eve of some happy reunion. Which, he supposed, she was. Which made what happened next that much worse. The smell of smoke reached them first, ephemeral wisps flitting through the trees, hinting at things untoward. Gregor smelled it and saw her doing the same, and then he saw her shake her head and ignore it. Denial, like hope, is a powerful thing. They emerged from the trees to find the writer's block in ruins. The land was blasted and black, some huge blaze having gutted the environs immediately proximal the woods. Few structures still stood, skeletal remains bearing mute witness to horrors beyond imagining. Roz staggered forward, then fell to her knees, sifting numbly through the ashes that gathered in papery drifts.
Roz,
Gregor started, then stopped. It seemed that now, here, words had failed in apocalyptic totality. Roz stood, whatever occult purpose in the ashes having been well completed, and staggered towards the city center. It got worse as they went. Huge, shattered piles of stonework stood sentinel on the roadsides, and Gregor saw in them the ruins of edifices rivaling any he'd seen in the Republic. An angel's face, having been fractured from some atomized bas-relief, regarded him from a pile of flittering ash, its blank eyes a study in idiot accusation. Gregor shivered and walked faster. He caught up with Roz, whose rhythmic cadence had carried her further afield than he would have guessed or was strictly comfortable with. She was standing at a crossroads underneath a lamppost, its cold cast iron having been twisted by some unfathomable heat. Her eyes wide, her dark hair turning slowly grey under a slow fall of drifting ash. Gregor drew aside her and looked around. The ruddy light that they'd taken for urban luminescence was naught but the product of a distant conflagration, nearby forest sentinels burning sorrowfully, aware that their lives were but a handful in the scores lost here as of late.
"Where is it?" he asked. "The spire, the great library, it can't have gone."
"It's still here," Roz said. "It's here and there. It's all around us." Gregor gazed around in wonder. The hunks of stone and twists of iron, ruins that he'd thought the remnants of multiple structures, revealed themselves upon inspection to be but parts of a whole, a massive, toppled structure that stretched near an entire radius of the city.
"My God," he breathed. "It must have been huge. Bigger than anything. But how?"
"The how is lost," Roz said. "But not all. Please God, not all." They followed the broken spine of the great building, observing here and there greater and greater drifts of ash, which Gregor realized at length to be all that was left of the library's contents. Empty covers lay like broken birds, their contents gutted, torn free, and immolated. A partially burnt page sailed on a silent gust of wind and snagged on Gregor's pant leg. He picked it free and read. "If people bring so much courage to this world, the world has to kill them to break them. So of course it kills them. The world breaks every one, and afterward many are strong at the broken places. But those it will not break, it kills. It kills the very good and the very gentle and the very brave, impartially. If you are none of these, you can be sure it will kill you too." He let the scrap fly free from his fingers, where it flittered off to parts unknown. They came, in time, to the mystically inscribed door, which still somehow stood. Roz spoke the words, her voice crackling like winter ice, and it swung wide to her, then crashed to the earth, sending up a great cloud of choking ash. "All is lost," Roz said.
"Perhaps," a voice said from the shadows, "but perhaps not."
Roz, lost in her grief, had let the lead-footed stranger steal up on them. She whirled, hands at the ready, but the voice's owner stepped free of the shadows, hands raised in apparent comity.
"Stand down, Roz," he said. "I mean you no harm, and even if I had meant it, I've not the martial wherewithal to acquit myself in the ring of honour."
"Then come free of the shadows," Roz said, surprising Gregor with a shift in her speech, her voice taking on a formal cant to match the stranger's own. She had an ear, to be sure. He made a note of that. The stranger stepped forward, keeping his hands well within sight, palms out at shoulder level. His shorn head stood in stark contrast to a great red beard that covered half his face. He was large, but not especially powerful-looking, which may have owed to the affable expression that he wore, or may have been the old-fashioned spectacles that he affected. In either case, there was very little threat to the man, who for all the world stank of hapless scholar.
"Who are you?" Roz asked. "And what happened here? Where is the block? The book?"
"I'll answer all, if you'll be so kind as to permit me lower my hands. Events of late have sapped me of my vitality."
Roz nodded. The man grinned wanly and pushed his glasses up his nose. "Much obliged," he said. "My name is Mikhail, and as you can see, the block is gone, along with its people. Most have fled for safer climes, some having turned." "And the book?" Roz asked again, desperation running through her voice like a bright thread. Mikhail regarded her for a moment, perhaps evaluating the trustworthiness of this desperate girl with her oversized pack and silent, dismayed companion. "The book exists still, as does hope," he said, and turned to pick his way back through the ashes.
"Wait!"
Roz called.
"No,"
Mikhail replied, disappearing again into a pool of shadows beneath a ruined narthex.
"There are those who need me more than you do. Return to whence you came, and bear the tale of what happened here with you always. Fare you well."
Roz thought desperately and called out,
"And what of Nedge?"
The large man's shadow paused on the event horizon of invisibility. He stood silent for a long time, then called,
"Come on, then."
Mikhail led them to the desiccated husk of what must once have been a pulp mill, judging by the smell. Even above the redolent miasma of ash, the sharp ammoniac tang of industry permeated the air, an olfactory phantom haunting the ruins. The machinery that had once produced paper of singular utility was now gone, having been ripped somehow from its moorings, leaving naught behind but geometric shadows on the bare concrete. The place was a ruin, but somehow clean, different from the out-of-doors. Roz and Gregor followed their guide as he silently strode across the large space, and then to a cast-iron staircase that lay steeped in shadow. They ascended single file into what appeared to have once been a foreman's office, a squat, cuboid shape set high into the wall. Mikhail fished a dull silver key from his pocket and used it to unlock the singularly unimpressive deadbolt set in the office door. He looked at Roz apologetically.
"No more fancy passwords," he said.
They went inside. It took their eyes a moment to adjust to the bright, unfiltered light that painted the room the color of honey. Gregor gasped, amazed, peering around. The perfect portrait of bafflement. The room hadn't changed, not much. The kitchenette was still there, as was the recliner and the modest desk. Even the broom, its wooden haft seemingly as ancient as the world itself, stood propped in the corner as if awaiting an industrious hand. But it would wait. As would the empty stockpot on the cold stove, as would the fountain pen, its nib gummy with dried ink, which lay fallow in one corner of the desk. But the broom, the lonely broom, somehow hurt Roz the most, seeing it and knowing that its purpose was all but done. It was terrible to see a thing of utility go to waste in such a fashion. Mikhail allowed her a minute full to reacquaint herself to the place before saying,
"She's on the balcony. I'll fetch her forth. Allow you to say your piece. But understand, if you place but one iota of undue stress upon her, I shall ask you, in no uncertain terms, to take your leave."
Gregor wondered what the man meant by that, but Roz said simply, "I understand." Mikhail strode through the kitchen to a large sliding glass door and slid it open, allowing in a fragrant gust of pure summer afternoon. Grass and honeysuckle and sunshine and warmth. But there was something underneath that too. Something Roz hadn't smelled last time she was here. An undercurrent of autumn on the march. something that smelled like mouldering jack-o'-lanterns and wind-whipped trees, of guano-speckled scarecrows. It was just a whiff, but it spoke volumes. Mikhail spoke to someone just out of sight, and then returned with Nedge in tow. She looked the same, but somehow not. She was still envisaged of those selfsame enormous brown eyes, that mop of dark hair. Her vitality was still there too, despite Mikhail's protestations. But there was something wrong with her. It took Roz a moment full to recognize it as solitude. Nedge was no longer a multi-person. Now she was just a person. Roz sat down, hard, on the nearby chaise. Bitter, brackish dust billowed out of it in a cloud, then settled, oddly disconsolate, to the already begrimed floor. In fact, as Gregor noticed as he peered around the room with as much discretion as he could bring to bear under such strange circumstances, the whole place, despite being sun-dappled and apparently free the surly bonds of conventional physics, was in a sad state of repair. The ecru wallpaper and walnut wainscoting were peeling and mouldering greenly, respectively. The ceiling was sagging in places, however subtly, and there was a multiply concentric water stain throwing its brown shadow in a far corner. A fine spill of dust cast its paw over every even semi-horizontal surface. Gregor reached out and ran his finger through a quarter-inch drift of the stuff gathered on the mantel over the cold hollow of the fireplace and peered closely at it. Ash. However removed from the real world this place was, it seemed not entirely immune to the destruction wrought on the other side. He turned and looked at Mikhail, but the other man had set about some mundane housekeeping task, what had all the apparent effect of ordering back the tide. "Strong I was last," Nedge was saying. "I think he thought that it would protect him, his strength, that it would help him outlast what was going on out there. I guess I thought so too. But then, one morning I awoke, and he was just gone."
"And no others have come to take his place?" Roz asked.
"No," Nedge said, "not a one. I sometimes wonder what is going to happen to the book when I'm gone. If anyone will remain to add to its pages, or if it will simply cease to be along with the rest of I."
"We're not going to let that happen," Roz said, "because I have a plan."
Gregor tried to make himself comfortable in an easy chair that smelled more than vaguely of mildew, as Roz outlined her plan for Nedge. The musician's gift for rhetoric, while rarely utilized, was quite an impressive force when brought to bear with purpose. She outlined what had happened since last she saw Nedge, spoke eloquently and not altogether dispassionately about the loss of Ivan and the orchestra. She broad-stroked her fight with Rhonda and said, and even included her rescue of Gregor from the perfidy of his former associate. And then she outlined her plan. To use the book. "We'll all go together," she said. "You, me, Gregor, and Mikhail. I know the roads between here and there. And besides, with such a multidisciplinary force in tow, I doubt that anything Silos could throw our way would so much as slow us down. We'll make the TR by the end of the month, get the book somewhere central, somewhere safe, and then we'll approach the TR leadership." Gregor's ears perked up at this last. Mikhail, from where he was scrubbing dishes in the kitchenette's grimy sink, huffed with apparent disdain. "The book will keep Silos at bay. At least for as long as it's going to take us to figure out who's responsible for the damned thing and mount an offensive." She leaned forward, looking into Nedge's eyes, earnest, desperate. We can stop what happened here. Push it back. We can save what's left of us. Nedge looked at her for a long moment and said simply, "No." Roz blinked once. Color suffused her cheeks, painted them the ruddy hue of anger. "Why?" she asked. "Do you want to know what happened to the block?" Nedge asked, by way of answer. Roz stood, deep fissures in her omnipresent composure. "What does that have to do with it? Of course I do," she said, her voice just shy, a cry of outrage. "It was just like this in the state, or haven't you been listening? Silos! Silos is what's happening here. It came in from the east and crushed everything in its path. It sent its agents to assimilate or annihilate. It rolled right over you and toppled the spire and crushed the innocent people who stood in its way. And now it means to do it again. And you're sitting here in your little pocket story world, safe from the coming storm. And when I ask for help, you sit there, calm and can be, and tell me no. So please, tell me why you're going to abandon everyone else out there in the real world. And pray, make it a convincing one." Mikhail had re-entered the room during Roz's rant and drawn close to his friend's side with an economy of motion unhinted at previous.
"You don't understand," he said, "but that might well be my fault. Rest here, Nedge, and I'll avail upon them what little I am able."
The library was a small room off the main, mostly free of the dimension-spanning ash that suffused the other space. It was the spire writ small, man-high bookshelves crammed tight with a seemingly random hodgepodge of literary works. Here, cheap dime-store novels rubbed shoulders with leather-bound symbolist tomes. A riot of tattered, dog-eared magazines held court in one corner adjacent volumes N through Q of an illuminated encyclopedia. Still, though, the shelves here seemed to span off ad infinitum, and this gave Roz hope. Mikhail saw her looking and said,
"It's all I could save. I know it seems legion, but the knowledge contained herein is but a scintilla compared to what has been lost."
"What happened?" Roz asked.
"Silos came, as you said," Mikhail replied, bidding them sit in orange plasticine chairs facing a humble desk, two sizes too small for the large man. "But they did not come from without. Had they? We might have saved more than these paltry few." He gestured around at the amassed books as if they were a tatty few novels in a bargain bin. "No," he said. "They came from within."
One year ago.
Jane casts another look at her office mate, Tyler, who looks altogether unwell. Not that he ever looked that well to begin with. With his pale skin and myopic demeanor, the young man who'd shared her space for the last 6 months was a study in block stereotypes. The kind of writer that musicians and artificers doubtlessly mocked over drinks. Oh, those block members. A nation of introverts and hermits, drunks and wastrels. I wonder they'd ever been around so long without falling asleep and burning the place to ashes with an errant pipe ember. That said, Tyler wasn't a bad guy. Nor was he an inconsiderate office mate. He always paid his dues on time, and not once had Jane had to remind him to pick up his trash or rinse out his moldy coffee cups in the sink. Overall, the young man with the ink-stained fingers and the unfortunate haircut was the platonic ideal of tolerable, if not entirely interesting in any discernible way. Put somewhat less charitably, Jane liked him because he was easy to ignore,
That was, at least until the last couple weeks. Last night, lying in bed, for a sufferer of the midnight disease was Jane, a malady which bade the afflicted lay awake into the small hours of the morning, their mind turning over events both important and superficial ad nauseam. She'd come to the conclusion that it had begun with the smell. Yes, that had to have been it. The subtle aroma of hot metal, of slowly roasting batteries, like a machine gone wrong. She'd smelled it before, had Jane. The smell of liver failure. A common enough smell in the block. The pundits in the other territories hadn't it all wrong. Brought on by too many late nights at the bar, themselves spawned by too many failed plot lines, too many characters found wooden and unbelievable upon closer inspection. But that hadn't been the end of it. Tyler had gone even paler, a feat she'd not thought possible, and had withdrawn further into himself. He hardly showed up to write any longer, and when he did, he pounded the keys of his ancient Remington with an angry fervor, whacking the carriage return hard enough to rattle their long communal desk. It scared her a little, his mute frustration, but then it hadn't been baseless. Jane had taken the agent to be untrustworthy from the start, but Tyler had seemed so elated at having found someone to read his work that she'd bitten her tongue and let the scenario play out. He'd introduced himself as simply Janklov, and he'd promised Tyler a bevy of riches, a long print run, and most importantly, recognition as one of the block's premier talents. All Tyler had to do was to make some market-specific changes, commit some social glad-handing, which Jane incidentally abhorred, and to let Janklov handle the rest. The process entire had taken months. Tyler neglecting his writing almost entirely to follow Janklov's roadmap to success. They'd traveled the length and breadth of the block, meeting the right persons, researching the key demographics, and, in Jane's opinion, kissing all the right asses. The night before publication, Jane had sat up with her sallow comrade, the very picture of filial support, while he bought round after round of cheap, rot-gut whiskey for the house, toasting him to the rafters and back. And then the returns had come in. 200 copies, Tyler had said to her, his face livid with his post-celebratory hangover. 200 copies of a 10,000-unit run. I'm ruined. Dear God in heaven, I'm ruined. Jane had been worried for him ever since, sure that one day she would arrive to work to find him gone, having fallen victim to his own perceived failure. But he'd still shown up every day, drawing ever deeper into some interior plane, treading the bleak distance between terse and mute with a grim celerity. It was sad, but not altogether surprising. But things had taken an even darker turn a few days ago. Tyler, sound of neither mind nor body to begin with, had taken a turn for the downright sickly. His skin had a clammy sheen to it, and his hair had begun to come out in clumps, leaving his scalp a crazy quilt of desultory locks. His eyes twitched to and fro, and he mumbled darkly to himself while he wrote. Finally, yesterday, Jane had approached him about it, tried to get him to open up to her, to unburden himself of whatever dark weight was dragging him down. But he'd somehow evaded even her most direct questions, intimating that rather than having become bereft of hope, he'd found a new, better patron. "Someone who's going to take all this pain away," he said. Jane hadn't liked the sound of that, and so after, she'd gone to Nedge at the library and told her all about it while the other of her looked on, silent. Fucking creepy, skinny, male Nedge said. Fecunded, the fat one said, around a mouthful of what appeared to be egg foo young. There was a rumble of general assent, but the muscular one, who Jane thought was, frankly, sexy as hell for a strange, extra-dimensional, multi-person construct. And the female one kept their counsel, at least until they'd escorted Jane back through the creepy word door. This friend of yours, female Nedge asked, how desperate would you say he was? Desperate? Rejection is a hard thing, the muscular one said, especially for writers. Some don't deal with it well. No kidding, Jane said. But some take it harder than hard, girl Nedge said. Some take, forgive the trope, desperate measures. Make bad deals with bad people. You think he'd ever go that far? Jane, too, had considered this. There were agents worse by far than a whole cadre of Janklovs, heartless remoras who'd just as soon suck the last erg of life from a writer as ferry them towards the halcyon shores of success. He might, she said. Bring him here tomorrow, the muscular one said, laying a comforting hand on Jane's shoulder. She tried not to show how much she liked it. We'll straighten things out for him. Maybe get him in touch with the right kind of agency. Plus, some time around the book couldn't hurt. Jane knew for a fact that it would help. There was something about the unassuming tome, with its multitudinous scribblings and printings, that suffused her with a mild euphoria after having been in its presence. And she always wrote like a woman possessed for days after having seen it, and thus was forever looking for an excuse to visit the librarians, muscular handsomeness notwithstanding. Now she is simply trying to find a way to broach the subject. Tyler sits, hunched over his typewriter, mumbling darkly to himself, pecking keys seemingly at random. His coffee, fetched forth by Jane as an amicable preamble to the day's work, sits tepid by his left elbow. His hair, what's left of it, is matted with sweat and oil. Finally, unable to stand it any more, Jane simply blurts, "They want to see you." Tyler starts, then wheels around with agonizing slowness to face her. "Who?" he asks, his voice hollow like an abandoned well. "The librarians," she says, more confident. She'd rehearsed this bit last night. "I told them that you'd been unlucky recently, and they asked me to bring you by. Maybe have you spent some time around the book. Get your head right." "Oh, you stupid bitch," he says, his tone bereft of inflection. "What?" Jane asks, incredulous. "What did you?" Tyler stumbles out of his chair, and behind him, on the platen of the typewriter, Jane can see what he's been writing all morning. Silas, 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 Silas.
You just couldn't let me be, could you?" he says, not hurrying around the desk towards her, slouching, twitching like a rough sack full of diseased rats. "Couldn't just let me be for one more day. One more day and I'd have had everything I'd ever wanted. But no, no. You ran tattle, tattle, tattle to the librarians to tell tales on Tyler. I didn't mean..." Jane says, slipping backwards out of her chair. She lands hard on her butt, her jaw snapping shut on her tongue. The pain feels very distant. Tyler laughs wetly and kicks her chair out of the way. Oh, you did. You did mean. Just like I'm going to mean this. Isaac Joseph, a pulp vendor of 20-some-odd years, is two blocks away when he hears the first scream. He waits, listens, and when it comes again, high and desperate, he drops his roll, valuable though it is, right in the middle of the street, and runs towards the sound of it. No thought in his mind save for how terrible the sound of it was, and how he might provide aid for the person in question. He rounds the corner outside the rented office block, where Jane and Tyler work, and pulls up short. A throng of impeccably and identically dressed men stand in the middle of the street. It takes Isaac a moment full before he realizes their suits are identical, that they have no faces. And just before the end, he finds the need to scream as well.
They came for our week, Mikhail said. They came for the desperate ones, the isolated ones in need of aid and succor, the ones that we, all of us, refused even the basest aid. And then they turned them. I want you to understand, laid bare our Achilles' heel, and they struck with singular intent.
Which is all the more reason to let us take the book, Roz said. Mikhail sighed, as if dealing with a child of singular obtuseness.
The book's purpose is to provide the animus of the block. It focuses and refines the energies here, bestowing upon those who require it a scintilla of our power as a whole, a bit of an egalitarian muse, if you will. But even as it empowers and refines us, so does it suffer with us. When the front men came, they preyed upon the weakness inherent in all of us, weakening the block entire, weakening the book. We rallied to it, of course. Those left unturned convened at the spire. We gathered around the book and around each other and found it to be enough for a time. There was only so long we could stand before the siege. Silos was all around us, and all through the day, we could hear them out there, destroying everything that we'd once held dear. I watched through a window as front men set fire to the pulp mill. Several pulp men, big, strong men, I'd seen heft 1,000-pound rolls, ran out to stop them. They didn't make it 10 feet before they disappeared under the tide, who'd once been their friends. The nights were even worse, though. They called to us in those terrible, manifold voices of theirs. I could hear friends in there, people I'd once known. They called and yammered and whimpered and begged us to come out. And some did. God help them. They just couldn't stand it anymore.
When did it end? Roz asked.
It didn't take long. Probably after the first librarian disappeared. The skinny one, as I recall. One day, he was there, and next, he was gone to wherever things like him go. We lost hope then, and with it, the power of the book. Whether we lost faith in it or it in us, I think I'll never know.
11 months ago. Mikhail wraps his light green coat around his body, and wishes that he'd had time to grab something warmer while he was running for his life. He should have asked the pulp men for one of their jackets before they'd gone out.
Say, I know you're going willingly to your ultimate physical and spiritual demise, but do you think you could be a pal and give me that great whacking coat of yours? Because I'd really hate to die of hypothermia before I can die from having my soul stomped out of me by faceless legionnaires.
He grins to himself and tries to stomp some feeling back into his numb toes.
At least those poor souls died close to a fire. Lucky bastards. Stump, stump. The sound of his footfalls echoes through the book stacks. He stands with his back to the door, behind which the remaining three librarians hold counsel. Mikhail is no warrior, to be sure, but he'll be damned if he's going to let some silos running dog pass this point. No, sir, no, ma'am. Die on his feet rather than live on his knees. Hang together or hang separately. It has been a long time since he's had a good meal. Stumpa, stumpa, or a good night's sleep. Mikhail closes his eyes and remembers his old workspace. Good chairs, good light, fine friends, smell of coffee. Not this dank passage smelling of pent-up hominids and fear. His head bobs forward and he sways on his feet. He jerks awake. His toes are numb. Stumpity, stumpity, bam! He feels it before he sees it. A huge, rolling explosion that rips through the space, kicking a tsunami of book dust ahead of it. The pressure wave of grit envelops him, and he slams back hard against the door. The words on its surface writhe in protest. Spitting dust and blood, Mikhail opens his eyes to find himself on the floor. The ceiling, high above, is crazed with a trillion fissures racing and widening with lunatic speed. As he watches, a huge chunk of marble pulls free of the ceiling and smashes a score of bookshelves to dust and splinters. He stands, groaning to himself, and realizes that he cannot hear anything, at least not well. Everything is ringing, and so he does not hear the frontman stealing up on him. He sees movement from the corner of his eye and tries to turn, but then it is upon him. It seizes him and looks at him with its non-face, and there is the terrible intimation of a smile in that blank face, and Mikhail's sanity slips sideways a bit.
"So you are the last," it howls into his face. "Too foolish to flee with the rest. Too foolish to let us in. We will have you, or you will stand here and die with the spire."
Mikhail tries to struggle free, actually manages to land a blow on the thing's eggshell countenance, but it shrugs him off like a spring rain.
"So be it," it cries, gleeful.
It tightens its grip and everything starts to go very dark indeed. "I hope it's warm wherever I'm going," is all he has time to think. And then, light. Burning, horrible, wonderful light. It slams into the frontman, who screams, scalded. Fatten Edge brushes past him and piles into the agent of Silos, slamming it into the ground. Mikhail stands there and goggles the sight. The thing under Nedge screams in protest, and like that, a dozen more frontmen, two dozen, three, emerge from the stacks, even as the spire crumbles around them. A Doric column pulls from the ceiling like a rotted tooth and squashed five of them flat. And still they come on, stepping over the shattered remains of their Nwasim brethren. Nedge strikes the thing underneath him a vicious blow across the neck, then stands and looks at Mikhail. His white face is sorrowful but resigned. "Get inside," he says in that mellifluous, calm voice of his. Then he turns toward the frontman and charges. And for a moment, Mikhail imagines that the frontmen are afraid. "Come on, you idiot," someone says from behind him. He turns to see Girl Nedge. She seizes him by the scruff of his neck like an unruly puppy and drags him through the door as the spire topples from the sky. When I'd steeled my nerve enough to pass yon portal, it no longer opened to the spire, but to this bleak place. I suppose the room is wherever it needs to be.
And the book? Roz asked.
Hidden, Mikhail said, and justly so. There are few of us independent writers left, and we still draw power from it, and by the will of Providence, we might all again someday. But until then, the book will stay here in the block, and Nedge with it.
Then we are lost, Roz said.
Not quite, Gregor said.
Mikhail and Roz looked at him, having forgotten for a moment that he was there. He'd been standing, near mute, in a far corner, eyes fixed on something in the middle distance, head cocked ever so slightly, as if listening to some inner narration. Now he stood, half wreathed in shadow, an ornate, leather-bound book open in his hands.
Here, he said, gesturing emphatically at the page. The conference! It's perfect!
What are you talking about? Roz asked.
I'd forgotten all about it,
Gregor said, with as much enthusiasm as Roz had ever seen him display.
I mean, we all read about it in school, but that was boring, so...
He stopped, sheepish.
Anyway, he said, the territories. They all participate in an annual meeting whose membership spans the TR.
What of it? Mikhail asked.
We get this guy, he scanned the page before him, the chairman. We get him on our side, get him to convince the key players, like Spencer and the Hammer, of the threat. We get everybody all in one place, and then we drop the silos bomb on them. Break it to them, so that they have no choice but to come together and do something about it. Hell, we could help you retake the block, the state.
It'll never work, Mikhail said.
Gregor looked crestfallen.
Why not?
The chairman is a figurehead at best, and an antiquated one at that. I seriously doubt he'd have the clout to bring the necessary parties together under one banner, let alone one bearing the legend Dire Straits Ahead.
Roz looked at Mikhail narrowly.
Gregor's right, she said. Yes!
Gregor replied, holding his hand up for a high five. Roz shot him a look, and he lowered his hand.
You will convince the chairman, Roz told Mikhail, because it's your responsibility, and because you know what's at stake if you don't.
But Nedge, he said.
But Nedge, nothing,
Roz said, stepping in close. He topped her by a head, and by 10 stone at least, but he stepped well clear of her as she did so.
You want to keep your friends safe? You want to protect the book? Then pack your bloody things and find him.
This last she punctuated with an index finger jabbed into his sternum. Mikhail looked at her for a long moment, then said,
Fine. I'll do it.
Roz snugged her pack over her shoulder, feeling that old familiar weight augmented by the care package of food that Mikhail had rummaged out of the decrepit kitchen. It totaled less than 3,000 calories of raw udon noodles and dried salted seaweed, but it would prove to be a welcome respite from her usual fare of foraged berries, suspect arboreal tubers, and the occasional unfortunate forest frog. Gregor, for his part, had recompiled himself a fresh pair of shoes, replete with gutta-percha soles harvested from a pair of sad, abandoned trainers found gently mouldering in a changing room locker. Roz had asked to borrow his terminus, which he surrendered with some hesitancy, and she disappeared with it into the depths of the abandoned warehouse for about a mysterious half-hour, during which Gregor could hear the faint, benign humming of his terminus well at work. She returned a short time later with a freshly compiled jacket in tow, similar in cut to her own,
yet lacking the travel-worn patina and myriad scuffs that marked it as a garment of singular utility. She handed it to him, and he was surprised to mark that she looked a little embarrassed. "Didn't know your size," she said. "Pegged you at about 100 centimeters round the chest. Lucky for me, you had a jacket spec on board for me to work with." Gregor hefted the jacket, a smile rising unbidden to his lips. It was heavy, far heavier than its leather shell and wooden liner belied, and stiff, too. He slipped it on and stretched his arms experimentally. It was warm and snug and fit surprisingly well. "This," he said, "is good work." "Stop it," Roz said, coloring a little. "Serious," he replied. "This thing shakes out all right. You should come work with me. You got a talent for it." Roz slugged him in the arm. It was a playful punch, but even through the jacket it hurt a little. Girl was strong. "See, now I know you're making fun," she said. "Only a little," Gregor grinned. Mikhail snorted from the open doorway at the top of the stairs, through which the sunlit room was still visible. "If you two are quite done," he called, "I'd just as soon attend the business of planning this doomed escapade." "Cheery bugger, isn't he?" Roz said.
"A little ray of sunshine, for sure. A people person of the first water."
Roz snorted a little at that, and Mikhail, unable to hear the exchange, glared at the two all the same. Clearly he wasn't pleased with his half the mission.
"Now then," he said, as he clumped down the stairs, "we know that the west and the north passages are closed by silos and deep snow, respectively, and I seem to recall you intimating that the south is lost as well."
"It is," Roz said, casting a quick look in Gregor's direction. Nothing registered in his face at the mention of his forsaken homeland. Time had taken its toll, it seemed.
"Well, then you shall endeavor the narrow passage," Mikhail said, unfolding Roz's map, which he'd been studying. "There is a spare isthmus of unoccupied land, a narrow pass, between here and the Republic. Silos has yet to have taken it, if for no other reason than that there is little there to take. That said, if they've caught wind of your intentions, you can be sure that they're lying in wait even now."
Roz thought back to Sed and Rhonda. Neither of them had been in any shape to pass information along to their fell collaborators. "I don't think so," she said. Mikhail rolled his eyes.
"How reassuring. In any case, I shall see you off and then follow a day later, after which I will marshal what forces I can before making landfall in the TR. After that, it will fall to fate as to whether or not I am able to convince the artisans of the gathering storm."
"The wolf at the door,"
Gregor agreed, trying not to smile. "A bad moon on the rise," Roz agreed, and she and Gregor burst into gales of laughter. Mikhail, for his part, stood there and let them laugh.
"Yes,"
he said at length, after their mirth had tapered to chuckles and snorts.
"My perspicacity is quite amusing, to be sure."
Roz wiped her cheek with one hand and said,
"Yes, sorry, just gallows humor. I've been at this a while, and alone at that, and well, for the first time it seems like there might be some hope left for all of us."
Mikhail nodded, in a fashion that he likely felt was quintessentially sage, and the two travelers had to bite back another gale of derisive laughter. Roz adjusted her pack one more time and said, "Are you sure you don't want to come with us? I know the way, and it might be nice to have another look at night, especially where we're going." Mikhail shook his head.
"Low. Though it seems a powerful shame to miss out on all this." He quirked an eyebrow. "Jocularity. I would do little more than slow you down. And besides, you need not worry for my safety. I have..."
Another pause. certain tools at my disposal that will win out against any force foolish enough to impinge my forward momentum. Roz thought about making mention the hyperbolically morbid scholar's penchant for ellipses, but then thought better of it. He would be risking his life too in the coming days.
"Okay then,"
Gregor said.
"Tally-ho,"
Roz replied.
"Bonne chance,"
Mikhail bade them, then made his trudging way back up the stairs towards the sunlit room.
"Bonne nuit,"
Gregor whispered to Roz.
"Bon bon,"
Roz whispered back, and the two stifled giggles all the way out of the building, then burst into fresh laughter as they trod through the dead ruins of the city.